We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, March 21st, and this means that Donald Trump, the executive out of New York, has until Monday to post a $464 million bond in a civil fraud judgment case. This, of course, is this ridiculously excessive fine that the state of New York has imposed against him and his businesses. So according to ABC this morning, New York Attorney General Letitia James is pushing back on Donald Trump's, quote, extraordinary request for a stay of his $464 million civil fraud judgment, arguing the former president's recent request was unreliable, procedurally improper, and based on a flawed premise. The senior assistant solicitor general of the state of New York said there is nothing unusual about even billion-dollar judgments being fully bonded on appeal, he said in the filing that came down this morning. And defendants object to a possible fire sale if they were to sell assets to generate cash to use as collateral for bond or as a deposit, but the alternative would be to shift the risk of executing on defendants' collateral and liquid assets to the Office of the Attorney General. So earlier this week, Trump's lawyers argued that the former president is unable to secure a bond for the judgment, having been rejected by over 30 insurance companies due to its size and his need to post properties as collateral. So if Trump does not post the bond as he appeals in the judgment against him, then Letitia James' office could begin the process of seizing his assets, including major New York properties such as 40 Wall Street and Trump Tower. It's unclear how such an enforcement effort would begin, according to the Washington Post, but James allowed a 30-day grace period that ends on Monday. She signaled that she was prepared to seize Trump's assets if the fine is not paid. Kevin O'Leary, who is most famous for Shark Tank, he's like Mr. Personality or something like that. He slammed the corrupt New York AG Letitia James, saying, "This has absolutely nothing to do with Donald Trump at this point. This is an attack on America. I don't know how you can look at it any other way." So this is a big deal, and especially following the fine and the judgment that is also in the E. Jean Carroll defamation case that is also potentially pending appeal. And so what generally happens, I mean, setting aside the obvious political issues here and the targeting, and I think this is a totally politically motivated prosecution from the New York AG, and the fact that she could only get a civil suit to trial. I mean, she had campaigned, obviously, you'll all recall, on getting Donald Trump, and she was looking initially at potentially criminal charges, but the best thing, or the biggest thing, the only thing she could file was, you know, this ridiculous civil case, and yet she got a $464 million judgment, which does seem very excessive, and what typically happens in a civil case, and this is where, don't confuse, like some commentators and some social media, you know, Twitter law experts have commented, don't confuse a bond in a civil judgment for appeal, or what's known as an appeal bond, with a criminal bail bond. These are totally two separate things. So in the criminal context, if you have to post a bail or post a bond because you are out of prison pending either a sentencing hearing or even pending the outcome of litigation in your trial, like the bond, for example, that that was required out of the Georgia case, right? That's and those everybody recalls was about, I think it was something like about $100,000 for most of the defendants there. Those are surety, typically done through sureties, and you pay a percentage and you can post a bond, and then you're not held in jail pending the outcome of litigation and all of the pre-trial and all of that. And that goes directly to the clause in the Eighth Amendment that says excessive bail shall not be required. And what does excessive bail mean? Well, there's a lot of bail reform, ongoing conversations in the whole criminal justice reform side of everything. And excessive really depends on the individual, their personal wealth, and a lot of different factors, even requiring in some instances that it has to be a cash bond rather than a surety bond or personal recognizance bond or other ways that you can post bond in a criminal context. A lot of people don't have, even if it's a smaller, misdemeanor case, a lot of individuals don't have even, $1,000 cash just laying around to post a cash bond. So, all of those questions are in the criminal context. Here, an appeal bond, the way that it generally works, and I'm not super familiar with New York law in particular. I've read up on a couple of things, but, I've never practiced out of New York. But generally, the way that civil appeal bonds work are that when you have a judgment against you as a defendant, like Trump does here in a civil case, different than criminal, a civil case, then the amount of the judgment plus interest has to be posted as an appeal bond in order for you to appeal. Unlike some of the issues and due process and other things, constitutional questions that are in a criminal case and appeals, and that's a whole other different situation. And you occasionally have to also post a bond or bail pending appeal in a criminal case if you end up moving forward. And your stay of the conviction judgment, moves forward. That's what didn't happen to Peter Navarro, for example. He had to actually report to prison. He couldn't stay his prison sentence pending appeal. But on the civil side, typically the judgment plus interest is then posted in the court's escrow account. So it doesn't actually go to the person that's owed. It doesn't go to, in this instance, the state attorney general's office in New York. It would go into the court's escrow account pending appeal. It's the same thing for the E. Jean Carroll case, if there are issues on appeal. And the reason for that, generally speaking, is because the court doesn't want just delay tactics and frivolous appeals and doesn't want to go all the way through the process just for a debtor to be able to try to delay having to figure out how to pay the judgment. So this also begs the question of whether the Eighth Amendment's other clause, and the Eighth Amendment text is excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. So excessive fines can be both the criminal and civil context. And courts have held generally that in civil litigation as well, there can be excessive fines. And in the civil world, that's why there's a lot of tort reform, ongoing conversations about juries that award enormous judgments. And in this particular case, $464 million as a civil fraud judgment, I think is excessive. It doesn't matter what, the senior assistant solicitor general is saying about, billion-dollar judgments and all of that. You have to look at the particular circumstances here in Trump's particular case. And this, in my view, was an obviously politically motivated prosecution. So the issue, though, for Trump is that typically for a company, when it's whatever the judgment is, let's say it's only $1 million for a much smaller company, they could either post that if they have $1 million liquid in liquid assets, or they could get an underwriter or a surety to guarantee. And typically what happens is that it's like 10, 15, 20% of the total judgment that the debtor would pay to a surety, who would then underwrite and say, and that's pretty much all that they do, and then tell the court, yes, if the judgment moves forward, then we will guarantee this as a surety. And that doesn't mean that they end up paying it and the debtor is off the hook. It just means that there's a guarantee and nobody has to put up the full amount of the cash right away. And the problem here, of course, for Trump is that he's been rejected by over 30 insurance companies due to the size of the civil fraud judgment. And frankly, I think because he's Donald Trump, and because some reports have suggested that he only has about $300 million in liquid assets, which is why he is challenging this and saying that he would like a stay of the civil fraud judgment completely pending appeal so that there's no need to post bond, or he should be able to post a less amount because this 30-day grace period isn't allowing him to actually go and get enough liquid cash in order to post that bond because he doesn't have an insurance company that will underwrite him. So all of this is going on at the same time that, of course, he's trying to campaign. And this is this really begs the question overall about what we've talked about since, I think it was last August of last year or so, when the very first case with A.G. Bragg, that or they're just the prosecutor from New York, filed his charges and saying, you know, this was intentionally a purpose to just bankrupt Trump. And it seems that these types of excessive judgments, that's the entire purpose here. And so from not only this defamation case that's been ongoing, and who knows the circumstances surrounding the, you know, the background of exactly why that came up at this point in time and that large judgment, now the AG, and then the DA, sorry, I misspoke earlier, he's not an AG, I promoted Bragg, which I shouldn't have because he's not worthy of promotion. He's just a DA in the state of New York. And his filing against Trump. So all of these things are working against Trump and obviously are distractions from moving forward. And so with the whole presidential campaign. And this is why I think that as we continue toward November, a lot of this is going to be even more politicized by the Democrats. I was listening to Apple News this morning, and, you know, they try to just pretend kind of like NPR and some of these that, oh, we're just, you know, reporting the facts. But the tenor of it is, you know, well, Donald Trump is on the brink of going bankrupt, basically, because he's going to have to sell off, you know, his assets. Letitia James has a number of options if he can't post the bond by Monday. And there's even a thing in New York called a restraining notice, which would require a person or an entity like Trump to refrain from paying the debtor any money or to transfer assets that they're holding or really spend any money until they pay off this judgment. And she could even do something as far as going into his bank accounts and seizing whatever liquid assets he does have. And apparently, according to this lawyer that was on Apple News this morning, who's in New York, he said that the statute in New York allows the seizure of money in bank accounts under this particular statute that Trump was found civilly liable for to liquidate his entire account, only leaving $3,000 because that's the statutory limit, which in New York, I mean, that doesn't even pay rent. I mean, that's just completely ridiculous. So all of this together, the bottom line here is that Monday is a big day. The insurance companies are rejecting Trump, so he's going to have to figure out what to do. And hopefully, I would hope that a court would see that there is definitely a reasonable argument for an excessive fine, that they would either, the court would either stay the judgment pending appeal or would allow him to post a cash bond that is much lower than the full amount, because this isn't just one of those normal cases where, no, we want you to post the full amount because this is a frivolous appeal or, you know, you may not be able to pay this. I think that it would be more than reasonable, but we'll see what happens. So don't confuse criminal bail or bond with this civil appeals bond. And we will see what happens and what effect, if any, this has politically moving forward. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and we are talking about the Monday deadline for Trump's request to stay his $464 million judgment in New York. And here to discuss and perhaps clarify even more than I did in the prior segment is our good friend Josh Hammer, who is a senior editor at large at Newsweek and had a piece on this very topic out yesterday. So, Josh, good morning.
Jenna, always a pleasure to join you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this fine does seem really excessive. And even though the Solicitor General is saying that there's nothing particularly unusual about even billion-dollar judgments being fully bonded on appeal, because Trump has been rejected by over 30 insurance companies, according to his filing, where does this place the court in potentially granting that stay?
Yeah, so I have a piece coming up on this for the Daily Mail, probably within the next hour and a half, actually. So I would encourage listeners to go over to the Daily Mail to check that out when it comes out. So this, to me, Jenna, of all of the lawfare against Trump and the case out of your home state of Colorado who tried to disqualify him from the ballot, was probably the most legally outrageous. That obviously was just swatted down 9-0 at the Supreme Court in the Trump versus Anderson case. But of all of the cases out there, to me, the most harrowing and bone-chilling is this case right here, is this civil fraud case in New York State. I mean, thinking about the possible mid- to long-term ramifications when it comes to quelling and tamping down possible investment. I mean, if you are an entrepreneur trying to be the next Jeff Bezos or Mark Zuckerberg, why in the world would you go ahead and try to launch a business at the garage as a budding young entrepreneur in New York State if you know that the power of the attorney general could then just turn on you and say, oh, no, I didn't like the way that you valued your assets here to try to secure this loan. I'm just going to go ahead and file a massive lawsuit to shut you down. The whole thing is just absurdly harrowing. And then, of course, in this specific case with Trump, the trial court judge, this Arthur Engoron, he denied a jury trial, and then he essentially said in a not-so-subtle statement mid-trial that Trump and the Trump Organization were already liable, and that made the whole thing fairly anticlimactic, and we were only wondering what the actual number would be. And then he includes almost $100 million just in backdated interest payments. That's how you get from roughly $355 to $454 million in damages. Then, to make matters worse, when Trump's lawyers tried to appeal to the appellate judge in the case, a guy by the name of Anil Singh, they said, well, can you let us get away with posting only $100 million, only, by the way, and, you know, kind of in scare quotes here. Won't you let us get away with doing this just as a bond payment? And then Judge Singh said, no, Tish James, the attorney general, who, by the way, ran for AG back in 2018 there in New York State, explicitly saying on the campaign that she was going to get Trump once she was in office, she is also now trying to prevent him from having an appeal. So the whole thing stinks to me to high heaven, Jenna. I think that this whole case is an absolute sham and an outrage. I really do. And I think that your mileage may vary when it comes to some of these other cases, but I don't really care what your political party or your political persuasion or identity is. I think what's happening in this particular case here, the denials of due process when it comes to your right to appeal, this outrageous judgment here, it's just awful. And it's frankly just patently un-American. And yes, I absolutely do think that it's entirely possible that we could start seeing some assets seizures as soon as next week.
Which is just incredible. And I completely agree with you that this is politically motivated. I mean, even Kevin O'Leary, you know, said that this is totally un-American. And I think you're absolutely right that it doesn't matter your political persuasions, your politics on Trump in particular. He is still an American that deserves due process, deserves fundamental fairness in the courts, does not deserve excessive fines. And this is just ridiculous. So hopefully he will either be granted that stay or can post a much lower bond for appeal so that we don't see some of those seizures happening as early as next week. But the political fallout of that, of course, is what the left is looking for, and the Democrats in particular. And that will play into the 2024 election cycle, of course, because it will be a position of weakness, not strength, to say, well, look, you know, you want to put this guy back in office who is going bankrupt and having his assets seized. I mean, there's no way to get around the politics on that. So we'll look forward to your piece in Daily Mail this morning by my guest this morning, Josh Hammer from Newsweek. But let's turn to another topic that is just as ridiculous, potentially. And there's so many stories to pick from daily. It's like I have to go through and filter which is the most ridiculous. And there are always so many options. It's like people always ask me, how can you fill in, you know, an hour radio show? And I'm like, I could fill 8 hours of ridiculous stories because of just how stupid the left and the entire woke agenda is. And this one is coming out of the Washington Supreme Court. This coming from the Post-Millennial. The Washington Supreme Court rules prospective lawyers no longer have to pass the quote-unquote racist bar exam, claims it blocks marginalized groups from practicing law. The court actually claimed that the bar blocks marginalized groups from entering the practice of law, and the bar has racism and classism written into the test itself. So, Josh, you and I both took different state bar exams. We both took the bar exam. This is a basic competency test to just know, do you know substantively a couple of areas of law? Can you think like a lawyer? Can you analyze topics? This is so beyond the pale. What's your reaction to this?
You know, Jenna, the more cynical side of me says that studying for the bar exam was one of the more miserable experiences I've probably had in my life. So I am somewhat sympathetic to those who will not have to prepare for it. But no, I'm just guessing, of course, and not being fully serious here.
Because every lawyer is always like, oh, the bar. You know, I had fun actually taking the bar. I really did. But that was just me. But I was homeschooled and I was the wonk like that. So, you know, we can agree to disagree on that one.
Yeah,
but go ahead.
I actually did enjoy studying for some of the substantive areas like constitutional law, contracts, torts, some of it, secure transactions, and some of the more arcane areas of the law. Not exactly my cup of tea, but
fair. I digress. I'll agree with you on that one.
So I think what's happening here in Washington State, to be honest with you, when I first heard about the story, I was actually a little surprised that only Washington State and Oregon are the only two states thus far to actually go ahead and do this. Because if you look at what's happening on the American left, especially when it comes to higher education and university admissions and things like that, there has been a total backlash against the notion of meritocracy. Everywhere you look, you see these elite high schools, Thomas Jefferson High School in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., that are cracking down on standardized testing. You see elite universities, like many Ivy League schools, that have even sometimes gone so far as to say that they will no longer require you to take the SAT or the ACT standardized test as a necessary condition for admission. You see this all over the landscape. And the reason for it is that, to kind of paraphrase the George W. Bush line about the so-called, quote, soft bigotry of low expectations, the reason for it is that these universities and these institutions have deemed that it is somehow racist or is inequitable, to use the perhaps preferred modern woke vernacular. It is inequitable to require everyone of all races and backgrounds to submit themselves to these same sort of standardized testing because, God forbid, Jenna, if you go ahead and do this, you might not actually get a pool. You might not get a group of lawyers, as the case may be here in Washington State, or you might not get a group of freshman students at Yale or Harvard or whatever, who perfectly match as far as the intersectional, you know, baskets, and they may not perfectly match the exact percentages of their broader representation in the actual American population. And to the Ibram X. Kendi anti-racism, critical race theory crowd, this is grounds for a huge outrage. And we've now seen this time and time again, is how these high schools are cracking down on AP courses and all these elite courses for the very simple reason that the students might look a little perhaps whiter, more Christian, more Asian, or more Jewish, or some combination thereof, than perhaps the broader population. And it's just so ridiculous. It's just so utterly ridiculous. And ultimately, as Heather McDonald of the Manhattan Institute, who writes about this issue frequently over there, as she likes to put it, this is ultimately a war on meritocracy. It is a concerted effort to crack down on competence and the good old-fashioned Western notion of meritocracy, the idea that if you work hard and that if you are diligent and that if you put in all the necessary conditions to achieve something, then you are the right person for that job. But when you start down the rabbit hole of trying to select people for a university freshman class or for a profession, when you go down the rabbit hole selecting them not for competence, not for merit, but because they happen to check some individual boxes, you're going down a really, really, really deep, deep, deep slippery slope there. I mean, are we going to start picking doctors, not necessarily because they have the most precise hands at the surgeon's table? Are we going to start picking airline pilots, not necessarily because they are the most skilled at actually getting a Boeing 737 off the ground and landing again? You know, given what's happening at Boeing these days, I definitely would rather have an airline pilot who's the most competent and not the one who just happens to check some sort of intersectional box. So the whole thing is just ridiculous. But unfortunately, as Ketanji Brown Jackson, the left-wing Supreme Court justice, spelled out for us quite clearly in her outrageous dissent in the affirmative action cases last summer, that's their worldview. This is their worldview. It's a race-conscious worldview. And ultimately, what it redounds to in practical terms, Jenna, is a war on meritocracy and a war on competence.
And I would say, Josh Hammer, that it is also, you know, a war on the American dream and the fundamental premise of what our constitutional republic was built on. And in terms of our implicit values, that is what they are purposefully rejecting. And they're trying to call that, you know, white supremacy. They're trying to call that racist. They're trying to unmoor us from our founding. And ultimately, to say that merit is not the basis and the metric by which we achieve, and we shouldn't even try that, but rather it's just these implicit characteristics. And yet, on the same hand, their worldview suggests that you can identify as any gender you want. And even if you are, let's say, you know, there are a lot of people that if you are a black conservative, well, you're not actually black enough to represent that left-wing demographic, because it doesn't actually matter the color of your skin. It matters the worldview that you're espousing. And so they have all of these inherent inconsistencies with their worldview. And so at the same time that they are pushing this whole woke diversity, equity, and inclusion, they're also saying that diversity itself is a social construct. I mean, how is this even comprehensible?
I don't know. I mean, it really does feel like sometimes we are living in bizarre times. I mean, we're dealing with situations on college campuses right now where you basically have inverse segregation at some of the most left-wing schools, where you have, especially in the aftermath of George Floyd and the BLM Antifa riots of 2020, you have situations on some far left campuses where you have all black dorms. And the purported reason for this is because they say that the students shouldn't have to deal with living next to oppressors, to use the preferred vernacular of the modern Marxists, the critical race theorists, things like that. They shouldn't have to deal with living with or rooming next to white students, things like that. You've seen at some other far-left universities separate graduation ceremonies for black and left-wing students. Look, Jenna, like you, I subscribe to a fairly radical ideology these days, an ideology that once upon a time was very mainstream. You know, it frankly is the ideology of Martin Luther King Jr. when he gave his famous I Have a Dream speech on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. back in the early 1960s, where he famously said, "Judge me not by the color of my skin, but by the content of my character." That really is not particularly crazy. And once upon a time, that was actually aspirational, and many people fought and died so that we could have a society that would actually live up to that. And now these lunatics, these mini Robespierres running around trying to burn things down on university campuses, are trying to dismiss out of hand Martin Luther King's legacy. And on the really far end of the spectrum, I mentioned Ibram X. Kendi earlier. He's the charlatan who is the leading proponent of so-called anti-racism. They are explicitly rejecting the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. They think that he is essentially a turncoat, sellout to their cause, because they want to live in a race-conscious society. It's essentially the inverse. It's the inverse of John C. Calhoun and the secessionists prior to the Civil War, really. And it's just an unfortunate twist of history that we've reached this point where the jerseys have essentially been reversed, but the arguments are very much the same. Look, Jenna, I'm born Abraham Lincoln's birthday. He is kind of my hero in American history. I just mentioned Martin Luther King Jr. earlier as well. I think the Republican Party and conservatives in general really should just grasp that mantle, because I think most common sense Americans are on our side on this one.
Common sense absolutely is, and we need to not shy away from all of these ridiculous labels like, you know, you're a bigot if you actually want some standards and you actually want your pilots and your doctors and your lawyers to be competent in their profession. And this even was coming from hot air this morning. According to a job posting, Mayo Clinic now is prioritizing people of color and criminals over white nurse applicants because they, during their hiring processes, they say they want to build an inclusive and just employment ecosystem. And we only have about a minute left, Josh Hammer, but you know, to say that this is more just to prefer the criminals and prioritize people of color over and discriminate against white people. I mean, this is absolutely what you were just saying. It's undermining the entire idea of what the entire civil rights movement of the 60s was attempting to advance. So your response really quickly.
Yeah, real quick. Look, criminals are very much at the top of the food chain when it comes to an intersectional pyramid. I mean, look what's happening in New York City, Jenna. We were talking about the Trump lawfare earlier. Alvin Bragg, the prosecutor there, is pursuing charges on so-called hush money payments for Stormy Daniels. Meanwhile, at the same time, people are getting away with bloody murder on the subways there. Everything is up, that's down, that's down, it's up. It's all just so fun.
It is. Well, Josh Hammer, I really appreciate it. Look forward to reading your piece in Daily Mail this morning. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Last year, because of you, Preborn's network of clinics saw over 58,000 babies saved. Thank you to all who made this possible. Let's celebrate these precious babies. Dominique really struggled with her faith when she found out she was pregnant. She didn't know how she could carry her baby to term, but she called on God for help and asked for a sign. That's when she ran into who she calls her guardian angel on the steps of the abortion clinic. This man told her there is a better way, and he walked her across the street to a Preborn Network clinic. When she saw her beautiful baby on ultrasound and realized that he was an actual person living inside of her, the answer became loud and clear. She chose life for her precious son. Each of these babies are truly miraculous, and every day, Preborn celebrates 200 miracles. $28 a month can be the difference between the life and the death of a child. When a mother meets her baby on ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection that doubles the baby's chance at life. Let's join together and help mothers choose life. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or visit preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And I was discussing with my great producers, Devin and Adam, during the break, because there was this question of in Washington State, in this last topic that Josh Hammer and I were discussing, the difference between lawyers and attorneys, and this whole issue in Washington State and now Oregon that says that to pass or they won't have a bar exam in order to become attorneys. There is a difference between lawyers and attorneys. So if you weren't aware, lawyer means that you are substantively knowledgeable and you have gone through a study of law. So for example, I have my Juris Doctor degree, so I am a lawyer, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you have power of attorney or that you are licensed in every state or jurisdiction. You actually have to pass the bar exam in most states now, apparently, other than Washington and Oregon, to have the power of attorney to go into court and represent a client's interest. And so there is a difference between the two. A lot of people go through law school. They never end up passing the bar for whatever reason. They're lawyers. They're not attorneys. Or, like I was telling Devin, his wife could give him power of attorney over medical decision making. He hasn't gone through law school. He didn't pass the bar, but it doesn't matter because the law allows him to represent her interests in a legal context for decision making through giving him power of attorney over just that specific element. So so power of attorney basically just means the ability to represent certain legal interests on behalf of another. So, all right, let's turn, though, to another very interesting topic, private home ownership in America. So this actually came from this account, Wall Street Apes, that that Texas Governor Greg Abbott actually responded to. And this is why TikTok, Instagram, and all of these social media platforms are quite fascinating because you get people who are speaking out on various issues that then some public officials, like a governor of a state, actually respond to. But this woman was talking about private home ownership being at extreme risk in America because new reports have shown that financial firms have been buying up single family homes to keep millennials and Gen Zers just renting for the rest of their lives. So listen to this, cut five.
I just watched what has to be one of the most horrifying videos I have ever seen on this app regarding our country's financial future. It was posted by a woman named Tiffany. I will link it. She's talking about how private equity firms have been buying up all the single family homes. So up until very recently, we didn't actually have the numbers to say just how many homes they've been buying up. And most politicians across the board, Democrat, Republican, whatever, have been saying, well, they're really only buying like 18% of single family homes. And then economists chimed in and said that if private equity firms are buying up anywhere from 18 to 20 to 23% of single family homes in this country, that by 2030, they would own 60% of all of the homes in America. Well, we just got the final numbers. In 2023, private equity firms purchased 44% of all of the single family homes in America, which means death for our middle class. Our generation will not be homeowners.
So Governor Greg Abbott responded to this saying, I strongly support free markets, but this corporate large-scale buying of residential homes seems to be distorting the market and making it harder for the average Texan to purchase a home. This must be added to the legislative agenda to protect Texas families. So joining me now is Tho Bishop from the Mises Institute, who has become our kind of resident economist. And Tho, first, your reaction to this, I would call it a crisis in the housing market. And Greg Abbott's response here saying he supports free markets, but, you know, Texas needs to do something about this.
You know, I think that definitely is a crisis, particularly when it comes to younger generations. And the larger consequences of that is that if you have young generations that can't buy a home, that put off having a family, then that's going to lead to a generations that have a lot less invested, are going to be a lot less conservative by nature. So this is a much bigger problem than just simply economics. I think within that TikTok video, the 44% number, I don't know if it's entirely correct, but it certainly does speak to a trend, which is that these large investors have been buying up houses. They have an advantage, particularly right now with mortgage rates as they are. You know, they don't have to, you know, so when you have them competing with, you know, a 30-year-old couple having to finance their houses, the larger institutional investor is often going to win that. And I think that what you're seeing is I think it's kind of reflective of a larger kind of trend with Republicans right now is recognizing that, like, first and foremost, the housing market is one of the most politicized markets in the country, right? There's a number of layers of government policies that have kind of been designed to prevent housing prices from going down. You know, the Fed buys up a bunch of securities. There's there are various levels to that. And so you have this federal environment that is creating economic stress. And then the question then is, what can or should states do to try to protect its own citizens from some of the consequences of federal policies? And I think that dynamic, it manifests itself in a variety of ways. We saw it kind of play out in some of the COVID policies in Florida. We see that with concerns about social media censorship. But here it is in this very specific form on, you know, what steps can be done to help try to protect younger generations from being able to have access, you know, to that first home ownership, you know, that first home you purchase, you know, which has always kind of been a representation of the American dream, if you will. And so I think it's very interesting from both an economic perspective on why we've gotten to this point, but also from a political perspective on what roles can states do to help try to mitigate some of the problems that the federal government itself has created.
Yeah, and that really is the next question, though, Bishop, is what can the states do? I mean, we've seen, of course, like here in Florida, that Governor Ron DeSantis and the Florida legislature have said that that the Chinese Communist Party can't buy land in Florida. And that makes sense that you wouldn't want to give any of our real property to, you know, and allow that to be purchased by a foreign government or even foreign agents, but particularly our foreign enemies, not even, you know, just our allies. But when it comes to corporations that do have rights here in America, what then can states actually do to try to curtail this?
Well, I think you're going to see more attempts to try to rein in these large scale, you know, institutional investor approaches to housing. Now, how that plays out, you know, when these pieces of legislation are inevitably, face legal scrutiny, it's going to come down to the design of that law, all of that. In theory, I think states have a lot more power with in terms of markets that are within the state itself. Of course, you can, you know, we've seen that twisted in a variety of ways when it comes to how the feds try to intervene within that. But I think some of those legal battles, again, I expect this is not going to be something limited to Texas. I think this is going to be something other states also try to attempt down the line. We'll see what the specific legislation looks like within that. But it's interesting, though, because this larger anxiety about first-time homeowners, there's a number of dynamics going into that. One is, you know, various restrictions on building itself, which has helped create particular problems in California. Blue states in particular have a big problem with kind of not in my backyardism that kind of has restricted construction, which cuts off supply or new supply of houses. You also have an additional dynamic where, you know, Airbnbs and the like in single family neighborhoods have kind of changed what a home, what a house is as an asset. So you're having fewer homes coming out of those houses and more kind of other different types of investor, it's kind of become an investment process itself. And, you know, traditional ways of dealing with that would say homeowners associations and the like, which I know a lot of people don't like homeowners associations, but it's kind of meant to try to address that at some of these local levels. And a lot of those abilities have been actually curtailed by states. I know in Florida, for example, it's very difficult to have any sort of covenant in a pre-existing community. And so there's a variety of these factors that are changing the way that the home market is from that perspective, without even going into the larger financial side and the way that the Fed has kind of incentivized, created an environment where this is a particularly attractive investment for institutional investors. And so I think that I'm glad that there is a recognition that younger generations, that this anxiety, I think, is very real. I think it's very dangerous to this country. And so, you know, what ends up being the model, either because I don't think there's going to be any political will to change the larger federal dynamic. And so that's going to lead to, I think, attempts at various interventions at the state level, which are going to have, you know, there are no solutions or only trade-offs. And so how that dynamic plays out with some of these states, I think addressing this issue for younger generations is going to be one of the, you know, more important ones going forward. And I think each state is going to try to address that in a variety of different ways.
I'm speaking with Tho Bishop from the Mises Institute, and you know, you mentioned that there is a definite political component to this. And is there something more nefarious, perhaps, going on with some of this corporate large-scale buying of single-family homes. When you look at what the left's actual agenda is, which is to really wipe out the middle class and have, more of just the aristocrats and sort of the plebeians, and to have this this destruction of ownership of property so that everyone is reliant on government. And it used to be at the founding of our country, voting was tied to property ownership because you had to have a literal stake in the country to be able to elect your representatives. And I think there are some really good arguments, frankly, going back to that. And I say that as someone who is currently renting, because I just moved to Florida and the housing market here has some definite issues. So we're hopefully we'll address that. But is this kind of a part of the left's attempt to keep the younger generation so dependent just on renting that they don't end up fulfilling the American dream, and they end up more with all of these different avenues, more likely than potentially to vote Democrat?
Yeah, I think there's definitely something on a higher level on, the kind of this larger, Davos goal of you'll owe nothing and you'll be happy dynamic, where they are perfectly content with the kind of the broader financial world that leads to these sort of outcomes. I do caution against, though, I do not want to suggest that the firms that are engaging this sort of behavior are themselves necessarily acting for that ideological purpose. I know BlackRock in particular is kind of thrown out there as a boogeyman. I've looked into that particular segment of it, and I think BlackRock's role in this has become a little bit overstated. I'm not here to defend BlackRock. They do plenty of bad things, but I think in this specific instance, they're not the major problem here. And so you have this dynamic where I think there's a larger ideological goal that has helped fuel some of these large-scale policies, but then you also just have this dynamic where it just makes sense as an asset class for certain corporations to utilize larger trends when it comes to renting, and they're responding purely from economic incentives. And this is kind of the problem, though, is that the current economy is so screwed up that it is very difficult to kind of discern between sinister behavior and simply people responding to the incentives, because the incentives are reflective of this larger financial landscape that the powers that be have created. And so I don't think this is a evil corporations are trying to do the bidding of the left. Some of them, I think, are just responding to what policymakers have created. The unfortunate reality is that it doesn't matter what the underlying goal of the actors in question are, the consequences are the same. And so whether they're trying to do the bidding of the Davos crowd or simply trying to shore up their long-term plans for their own financial well-being, at the end of the day, it's younger generations that are paying the price for it. And again, the conditions that it's setting for younger generations is going to be ones that are less self-dependent and I think less connected to a lot of the factors that have always made America exceptional in that sort of self-reliance, individualistic mentality that I think is so important to any future success this country has.
Yeah, so well said. And I think you're absolutely right that, it is a variety of factors, and it may just be some of these corporations that are responding to the current cultural climate. I mean, and as we've seen the effects of the pervasive sexual revolution over the last 50 and 60 years, and with the younger generations waiting longer to get married, and some who, are the two income households, but they don't necessarily even want to buy, or, all of these people who want to just go on trips and not necessarily focus so much on their home and traditional family and values, then that does shape a lot of the society. And so as we're seeing the practical effects of a culture that has gone against God's design for local church, for family, and for civic engagement, then we're seeing a lot of these consequences that play out and ultimately do play right into the hands of the left and the WEF and some of these things. So at some point, maybe tomorrow on Friday, I want to rant a little bit more about that and some of the cultural implications and where I think the church is absolutely failing single people in particular. But that's a conversation for another day. We are already out of time. Here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning, you can always reach me and my team at jenna@afr.net. Make it a great day.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.